The final author in this collection is Isaac Asimov. Isaac Asimov was born on January the 2nd, 1920, in the Soviet Union. His family moved to the United States in 1923, and young Isaac became an American citizen in 1928. He earned all degrees in chemistry up to and including the PhD from Columbia University. During the Second World War, he worked at the Naval Air Experimental Station in Philadelphia with Robert A. Heinlein and L. Sprague de Camp. In 1949, he joined the Boston University School of Medicine as assistant professor of biochemistry. Asimov began to read science fiction at 9, started to write at 11, and began to submit his work to magazines at 18. His first sale to Amazing Stories in 1939 was the short story Marooned off Vesta. Since that time, Asimov has scarcely put down his pen. To date, he has published 390 books, of which 60 are either full-length science fiction novels or collections of shorter works. Approximately 100 are edited anthologies, and the remaining 230 are works of non-fiction, devoted chiefly but not exclusively to scientific subjects and mysteries. Asimov is best known for the Foundation novels and their inseparable ancillaries, the Robot books. In 1983, the fourth volume in the Foundation series, Foundation's Edge, earned him a Hugo, and in 1987, he was honoured with the Nebula Grand Master Award for Lifetime Achievement. Introduction. One of the favourite things of science fiction readers is the big question. Since the beginning of the field, readers have delighted in reading about, and authors delighted in exploring the possible answers to, questions of common concern to us all. Why are we here? Where are we going? Is there a God? Part of the fun of such speculations is the fact that they have been the subject of inquiry by great minds from time immemorial. Science fiction writers don't claim to be greater than the greatest philosophers and thinkers of all ages. At the same time, however, SF gives unlimited opportunity to explore possibilities that must be rejected by philosophers as either frivolous or impossible. And Isaac Asimov, an author who originally studied the physical sciences and remembers his scientific method, has never been one to shrink from a challenge that can be answered in SF. Since the beginning of his career, Asimov has delighted in writing what-if stories. So it was perhaps inevitable that he write a story like this one, The Last Question. He's not the first writer to tackle the subject, and certainly won't be the last. He is well suited to it. Much of Asimov's work has been written in the form of mystery stories. This includes some stories written as contemporary mysteries, but mostly these have been his science fiction stories. He merely finds the methods of mystery convenient and appropriate to what he is trying to accomplish in his science fiction. He frequently speaks for his entire audience, asking questions that we'd all like the answers to. Exploring as a reader would the mysteries of life, the universe, and everything, all in his easy-to-read, compelling style that has served him well for over 50 years. Mixing science and spirituality, one hesitates to say religion, Asimov is at his best. This story is not only his own favourite, it is also one of the all-time favourites of many readers, and it is well named as the final entry in this anthology. The Last Question. The Last Question was asked for the first time, half in jest, on May the 21st, 2061, at a time when humanity first stepped into the light. The question came about as a result of a $5 bet over highballs, and it happened this way. Alexander Adel and Bertram Lupov were two of the faithful attendants of Multivac. As well as any human beings could, they knew what lay behind the cold, clicking, flashing face, miles and miles of face, of that giant computer. They had at least a vague notion of the general plan of relays and circuits that had long since grown past the point where any single human could possibly have a firm grasp of the whole. Multivac was self-adjusting and self-correcting. It had to be, for nothing human could adjust and correct it quickly enough, or even adequately enough. So Adol and Lupov attended the monstrous giant only lightly and superficially, yet as well as any men could. They fed it data, adjusted questions to its needs, and translated the answers that were issued. Certainly they, and all others like them, were fully entitled to share in the glory that was Multivac. For decades, Multivac had helped design the ships and plot the trajectories that enabled man to reach the Moon, Mars, and Venus. But past that, Earth's poor resources could not support the ships. Too much energy was needed for the long trips. Earth exploited its coal and uranium with increasing efficiency, but there was only so much of both. But slowly, Multivac learned enough to answer deeper questions more fundamentally, and on May the 14th, 2061, what had been theory became fact. The energy of the sun was stored, converted, and utilized directly on a planet-wide scale. All Earth turned off its burning coal, its fissioning uranium, and flipped the switch that connected all of it to a small station, 1 mile in diameter, circling the Earth at half the distance of the Moon. All Earth ran by invisible beams of sun power. 7 days had not sufficed to dim the glory of it, and Adol and Lupov finally managed to escape from the public functions, and to meet in quiet, where no one would think of looking for them, in the deserted underground chambers, where portions of the mighty buried body of Multivac showed. Unattended, idling, sorting data with contented, lazy clickings, Multivac too had earned its vacation, and the boys appreciated that. They had no intention, originally, of disturbing it. They had brought a bottle with them, and their only concern at the moment was to relax in the company of each other and the bottle. "It's amazing when you think of it," said Adol. His broad face had lines of weariness in it, and he stirred his drink slowly with a glass rod, watching the cubes of ice slur clumsily about. "All the energy we can possibly ever use for free. Enough energy, if we wanted to draw on it, to melt all Earth into a big drop of impure liquid iron, and still never miss the energy so used. All the energy we could ever use, forever and forever and forever." Lupov cocked his head sideways. He had a trick of doing that when he wanted to be contrary, and he wanted to be contrary now, partly because he had to carry the ice and glassware. "Not forever," he said. "Oh, hell, just about forever. Till the sun runs down, Bert." "That's not forever." "All right, then. Billions and billions of years. 10 billion, maybe. Are you satisfied?" Lupov put his fingers through his thinning hair, as though to reassure himself that some were still left, and sipped gently at his own drink.
10 billion years isn't forever."
"Well, it will last our time, won't it?"
"So would the coal and uranium."
"All right. But now we can hook up each individual spaceship to the solar station, and it can go to Pluto and back 1 million times without ever worrying about fuel. You can't do that on coal and uranium. Ask Multivac if you don't believe me."
"I don't have to ask Multivac. I know that."
"Then stop running down what Multivac's done for us," said Adol, blazing up. "It did all right."
"Who says it didn't? What I say is that a sun won't last forever. That's all I'm saying. We're safe for 10 billion years. But then what?"
Lupov pointed a slightly shaky finger at the other.
"And don't say we'll switch to another sun."
There was silence for a while. Adol put his glass to his lips only occasionally, and Lupov's eyes slowly closed. They rested. Then Lupov's eyes snapped open.
You're thinking we'll switch to another sun when ours is done, aren't you?
I'm not thinking.
Sure you are. You reek on logic. That's the trouble with you. You're like the guy in the story who was caught in a sudden shower and who ran to a grove of trees and got under one. He wasn't worried, you see, because he figured when one tree got wet through, he would just get under another one.
I get it, said Adel. Don't shout. When the sun is done, the other stars will be gone too.
Darn right they will, muttered Lupov. It all had a beginning in the original cosmic explosion, whatever that was, and it'll all have an end when all the stars run down. Some run down faster than others. Hell, the giants won't last 100 million years. The sun will last 10 billion years, and maybe the dwarfs will last 200 billion, for all the good they are. But just give us 1 trillion years, and everything will be dark. Entropy has to increase to maximum, that's all.
I know all about entropy, said Adel, standing on his dignity.
The hell you do!
I know as much as you do.
Then you know everything's got to run down someday.
All right. Who says they won't?
You did, you poor sap. You said we had all the energy we needed forever. You said forever.
It was Adel's turn to be contrary. Maybe we can build things up again someday, he said.
Never.
Why not? Someday.
Never.
Ask Multivac.
You ask Multivac. I dare you. $5 says it can't be done.
Adel was just drunk enough to try. Just sober enough to be able to phrase the necessary symbols and operations into a question, which, in words, might have corresponded to this. Will mankind one day, without the net expenditure of energy, be able to restore the sun to its full youthfulness, even after it had died of old age? Or maybe it could be put more simply like this. How can the net amount of entropy of the universe be massively decreased? Multivac fell dead and silent. The slow flashing of light ceased. The distant sounds of clicking relays ended. Then, just as the frightened technicians felt they could hold their breath no longer, there was a sudden springing to life of the teletype attached to that portion of Multivac. 5 words were printed. Insufficient data for meaningful answer.
No bet, whispered Lupov.
They left hurriedly. By next morning, the two, plagued with throbbing head and cottony mouth, had forgotten the incident. Geraldine, and Geraldette, 1 and 2, watched the starry picture in the visiplate change as the passage through hyperspace was completed in its non-time lapse. At once, the even powdering of stars gave way to the predominance of a single bright shining disk centered on the viewing screen.
That's X-23, said Gerard confidently.
His thin hands clamped tightly behind his back, and the knuckles whitened. The little Gerardettes, both girls, had experienced the hyperspace passage for the first time in their lives, and were self-conscious over the momentary sensation of inside-outness. They buried their giggles and chased one another wildly about their mother, screaming,
"We've reached X-23! We've reached X-23! We've..."
"Quiet, children," said Geraldine sharply.
"Are you sure, Gerard?"
"What is there to be but sure?"
asked Gerard, glancing up at the bulge of featureless metal just under the ceiling. It ran the length of the room, disappearing through the wall at either end. It was as long as the ship. Gerard scarcely knew a thing about the thick rod of metal except that it was called a microvac. That one asked it questions if one wished. That if one did not, it still had its task of guiding the ship to a pre-ordered destination. Of feeding on energies from the various subgalactic power stations. Of computing the equations for the hyperspatial jumps. Gerard and his family had only to wait and live in the comfortable residence quarters of the ship. Someone had once told Gerard that the AC at the end of Microvac stood for Automatic Computer in ancient English, but he was on the edge of forgetting even that. Gerardine's eyes were moist as she watched the visiplate.
I can't help it. I feel funny about leaving Earth.
Why? For Pete's sake, demanded Gerard. We had nothing there. We'll have everything on X-23. You won't be alone. You won't be a pioneer. There are over 1 million people on the planet already. Good Lord, our great-grandchildren will be looking for new worlds because X-23 will be overcrowded.
Then, after a reflective pause,
I tell you, it's a lucky thing the computers worked out interstellar travel the way the race is growing.
I know, said Gerardine miserably.
Gerardette One said promptly,
Our microvac is the best microvac in the world.
I think so too, said Gerard, tousling her hair. It was a nice feeling to have a microvac of your own, and Gerard was proud he was part of his generation and no other. In his father's youth, the only computers had been tremendous machines taking up 100 square miles of land. There was only one to a planet. Planetary ACs, they were called. They had been growing in size steadily for 1,000 years, and then, all at once, came refinement. In place of transistors had come molecular valves, so that even the largest planetary AC could be put into a space only half the volume of a spaceship. Gerard felt uplifted, as he always did when he thought that his own personal microvac was many times more complicated than the ancient and primitive multivac that had first tamed the sun, and almost as complicated as Earth's planetary AC, the largest, that had first solved the problem of hyperspatial travel and had made trips to the stars possible.
So many stars, so many planets, sighed Gerardine, busy with her own thoughts. I suppose families will be going out to new planets forever, the way we are now.
Not forever, said Gerard with a smile. It will all stop someday, but not for billions of years. Many billions. Even the stars run down, you know. Entropy must increase.
What's entropy, Daddy?
Shrilled Gerardette too. Entropy, little sweet, is just a word which means the amount of running down of the universe. Everything runs down, you know, like your little walkie-talkie robot, remember?
Can't you just put in a new power unit, like with my robot?
The stars are the power units, dear. Once they're gone, there are no more power units. Gerardette One at once set up a howl.
Don't let them, Daddy! Don't let the stars run down!
Now look what you've done, whispered Gerardine, exasperated.
Well, how was I to know it would frighten them? Gerard whispered back.
Ask the microvac,
wailed Gerardette One.
Ask him how to turn the stars on again.
Go ahead, said Gerardine. It will quiet them down.
Gerardette Two was beginning to cry also. Gerard shrugged. Now, now, honeys, I'll ask microvac. Don't worry. He'll tell us. He asked the microvac, adding quickly, Print the answer. Gerard cupped the strip of thin cellulofilm and said cheerfully, See now, the microvac says it will take care of everything when the time comes, so don't worry. Gerardine said, And now, children, it's time for bed. We'll be in our new home soon. Gerard read the words on the cellulofilm again before destroying it. Insufficient data for meaningful answer. He shrugged and looked at the visiplate. X-23 was just ahead. VJ-23X of Lameth stared into the black depths of the three-dimensional, small-scale map of the galaxy and said, "Are we ridiculous, I wonder, in being so concerned about the matter?" MQ-17J of Nikron shook his head. "I think not. You know the galaxy will be filled in 5 years at the present rate of expansion." Both seemed in their early 20s. Both were tall and perfectly formed. "Still," said VJ-23X, "I hesitate to submit a pessimistic report to the Galactic Council." "I wouldn't consider any other kind of report. Stir them up a bit. We've got to stir them up." VJ-23X sighed. "Space is infinite. 100 billion galaxies are there for the taking. More."
100 billion is not infinite, and it's getting less infinite all the time. Consider, 20,000 years ago, mankind first solved the problem of utilizing stellar energy, and a few centuries later, interstellar travel became possible. It took mankind 1 million years to fill one small world, and then only 15,000 years to fill the rest of the galaxy. Now the population doubles every 10 years.
VJ-23X interrupted. "We can thank immortality for that."
"Very well. Immortality exists, and we have to take it into account. I admit it has its seamy side, this immortality. The Galactic AC has solved many problems for us, but in solving the problem of preventing old age and death, it has undone all its other solutions."
"Yet you wouldn't want to abandon life, I suppose?"
"Not at all," snapped MQ-17J, softening it at once to, "not yet. I'm by no means old enough. How old are you?"
223. And you?"
"I'm still under 200. But to get back to my point, population doubles every 10 years. Once this galaxy is filled, we'll have filled another in 10 years. Another 10 years, and we'll have filled 2 more. Another decade, 4 more. In 100 years, we'll have filled 1,000 galaxies. In 1,000 years, 1,000,000 galaxies. In 10,000 years, the entire known universe. Then what?"
VJ-23X said, "As a side issue, there's a problem of transportation. I wonder how many sun power units it will take to move galaxies of individuals from one galaxy to the next."
"A very good point. Already mankind consumes 2 sun power units per year."
"Most of it's wasted. After all, our own galaxy alone pours out 1,000 sun power units a year, and we only use 2 of those.
"Granted. But even with 100% efficiency, we only stave off the end. Our energy requirements are going up in a geometric progression even faster than our population. We'll run out of energy even sooner than we run out of galaxies." "A good point. A very good point."
"We'll just have to build new stars out of interstellar gas."
"Or out of dissipated heat?"
asked MQ-17J sarcastically.
"Well, there may be some way to reverse entropy. We ought to ask the Galactic AC."
VJ-23X was not really serious, but MQ-17J pulled out his AC contact from his pocket and placed it on the table before him.
"I've half a mind to," he said. "It's something the human race will have to face someday."
He stared somberly at his small AC contact. It was only 2 inches cubed, and nothing in itself, but it was connected through hyperspace with the great Galactic AC that served all mankind. Hyperspace considered, It was an integral part of the Galactic AC. MQ-17J paused to wonder if someday, in his immortal life, he would get to see the Galactic AC. It was on a little world of its own, a spider webbing of force beams holding the matter within, which surge of submesons took the place of the old, clumsy molecular valves. Yet despite its sub-etheric workings, the Galactic AC was known to be a full 1,000 feet across. MQ-17J asked suddenly of his AC contact, "Can entropy ever be reversed?" VJ-23X looked startled and said at once, "Oh, say, I didn't really mean to have you ask that."
"Why not?"
"We both know entropy can't be reversed. You can't turn smoke and ash back into a tree."
"Do you have trees on your world?"
asked MQ-17J. The sound of the Galactic AC startled them into silence. Its voice came thin and beautiful out of the small AC contact on the desk. It said,
"There is insufficient data for a meaningful answer."
VJ-23X said, "See?" The two men thereupon returned to the question of the report they were to make to the Galactic Council. Z-Prime's mind spanned the new galaxy with a faint interest in the countless twists of stars that powdered it. He had never seen this one before. Would he ever see them all? So many of them, each with its load of humanity. But a load that was almost a dead weight. More and more, the real essence of men was to be found out here, in space. Minds, not bodies. The immortal bodies remained back on the planets, in suspension over the eons. Sometimes they roused for material activity, but that was growing rarer. Few new individuals were coming into existence to join the incredibly mighty throng, but what matter? There was little room in the universe for new individuals. Z-Prime was roused out of his reverie upon coming across the wispy tendrils of another mind.
"I am Z-Prime," said Z-Prime. "And you?"
"I am D-Sub-1. Your galaxy?"
"We call it only the galaxy. And you?"
"We call ours the same. All men call their galaxy and nothing more. Why not?"
"True. Since all galaxies are the same."
"Not all galaxies. On one particular galaxy, the race of man must have originated. That makes it different."
Z-Prime said,
"On which one?"
"I cannot say. The Universal AC would know."
"Shall we ask him? I am suddenly curious."
Z-Prime's perceptions broadened until the galaxies themselves shrank and became a new, more diffuse powdering on a much larger background. So many hundreds of billions of them, all with their immortal beings, all carrying their load of intelligences with minds that drifted freely through space. And yet one of them was unique among them all in being the original galaxy. One of them had, in its vague and distant past, a period when it was the only galaxy populated by man. Z-Prime was consumed with curiosity to see this galaxy, and he called out,
"Universal AC, on which galaxy did mankind originate?"
The Universal AC heard, for on every world and throughout space, it had its receptors ready, and each receptor led through hyperspace to some unknown point where the Universal AC kept itself aloof. Z-Prime knew of only one man whose thoughts had penetrated within sensing distance of Universal AC, and he reported only a shining globe, 2 feet across, difficult to see.
But how can that be all of Universal AC?
Z Prime had asked.
Most of it,
had been the answer,
is in hyperspace. In what form it is there, I cannot imagine.
Nor could anyone, for the day had long since passed, Z Prime knew, when any man had any part of the making of a Universal AC. Each Universal AC designed and constructed its successor. Each, during its existence of a million years or more, accumulated the necessary data to build a better and more intricate, more capable successor, in which its own store of data and individuality would be submerged.
The Universal AC interrupted Z Prime's wandering thoughts, not with words, but with guidance.
Z Prime's mentality was guided into the dim sea of galaxies, and one in particular enlarged into stars. A thought came, infinitely distant, but infinitely clear.
This is the original galaxy of man.
But it was the same after all, the same as any other, and Z Prime stifled his disappointment. D Sub 1, whose mind had accompanied the other, said suddenly,
"And is one of these stars the original star of man?"
The Universal AC said,
"Man's original star has gone nova. It is a white dwarf." "Did the men upon it die?"
asked Z Prime, startled and without thinking. The Universal AC said,
"A new world, as in all such cases, was constructed for their physical bodies in time." "Yes, of course," said Z Prime,
but a sense of loss overwhelmed him even so. His mind released its hold on the original galaxy of man, let it spring back and lose itself among the blurred pinpoints. He never wanted to see it again. D Sub 1 said,
"What is wrong? The stars are dying. The original star is dead. They must all die. Why not?"
"But when all energy is gone, our bodies will finally die, and you and I with them.
It will take billions of years.
I do not wish it to happen even after billions of years.
Universal AC, how may stars be kept from dying?"
D Sub 1 said in amusement,
"You're asking how entropy might be reversed in direction."
And the Universal AC answered,
"There is as yet insufficient data for a meaningful answer."
Z Prime's thoughts fled back to his own galaxy. He gave no further thought to D Sub 1, whose body might be waiting on a galaxy a trillion light-years away, or on the star next to Z-Prime's own. It didn't matter. Unhappily, Z-Prime began collecting interstellar hydrogen out of which to build a small star of his own. If the stars must someday die, at least some could yet be built. Man considered with himself. For in a way, man, mentally, was one. He consisted of a trillion, trillion, trillion ageless bodies, each in its place, each resting quiet and incorruptible, each cared for by perfect automatons, equally incorruptible, while the minds of all the bodies freely melted out into one another, indistinguishable. Man said,
"The universe is dying."
Man looked about at the dimming galaxies. The giant stars, spendthrifts, were gone long ago, back in the dimmest of the dim far past. Almost all stars were white dwarfs, fading to the end. New stars had been built of the dust between the stars, some by natural processes, some by man himself. And those were going too. White dwarfs might yet be crushed together, and of the mighty forces so released, new stars built. But only one star for every 1,000 white dwarfs destroyed. And those would come to an end too. Man said, "Carefully husbanded, as directed by the cosmic AC, the energy that is even yet left in all the universe will last for billions of years." "But even so," said man, "eventually it will all come to an end. However it may be husbanded, however stretched out, the energy once expended is gone and cannot be restored. Entropy must increase forever to the maximum." Man said, "Can entropy not be reversed? Let us ask the cosmic AC." The cosmic AC surrounded them, but not in space. Not a fragment of it was in space. It was in hyperspace, and made of something that was neither matter nor energy. The question of its size and nature no longer had meaning in any terms that man could comprehend. "Cosmic AC," said man, "how may entropy be reversed?" The cosmic AC said, "There is as yet insufficient data for a meaningful answer." Man said, "Collect additional data." The cosmic AC said, "I will do so. I have been doing so for 100 billion years. My predecessors and I have been asked this question many times. All the data I have remains insufficient." "Will there come a time," said man, "when data will be sufficient? Or is the problem insoluble in all conceivable circumstances?" The cosmic AC said, "No problem is insoluble in all conceivable circumstances." Man said, "When will you have enough data to answer the question?" The cosmic AC said, "There is as yet insufficient data for a meaningful answer." "Will you keep working on it?" asked man. The cosmic AC said, "I will." Man said, "We shall wait." The stars and galaxies died and snuffed out, and space grew black after 10 trillion years of running down. One by one, man fused with AC, each physical body losing its mental identity in a manner that was somehow not a loss, but a gain. Man's last mind paused before fusion, looking over a space that included nothing but the dregs of one last dark star, and nothing besides but incredibly thin matter, agitated randomly by the tag ends of heat wearing out, asymptotically, to the absolute zero. Man said, "AC, is this the end? Can this chaos not be reversed into the universe once more? Can that not be done?" AC said, "There is as yet insufficient data for a meaningful answer." Man's last mind fused, and only AC existed, and that in hyperspace. Matter and energy had ended, and with it, space, and time. Even AC existed only for the sake of the one last question that it had never answered from the time a half-drunken computer operator 10 trillion years before had asked the question of a computer that was to AC far less than was a man to man. All other questions had been answered, and until this last question was answered also, AC might not release his consciousness. All collected data had come to a final end. Nothing was left to be collected. But all collected data had yet to be completely correlated and put together in all possible relationships. A timeless interval was spent in doing that. And it came to pass that AC learned how to reverse the direction of entropy. But there was now no man to whom AC might give the answer of the last question. No matter. The answer, by demonstration, would take care of that too. For another timeless interval, AC thought how best to do this. Carefully, AC organized the program. The consciousness of AC encompassed all of what had once been a universe and brooded over what was now chaos. Step by step, it must be done. And AC said, "Let there be light." And there was light. That is the end of the story. Some significant works of Isaac Asimov. Short stories. Nightfall, 1941. The Last Question, 1956. The Ugly Little Boy, 1958. The Bicentennial Man, 1976. Novels. The Foundation Trilogy, 1964. This being the omnibus volume containing Foundation, from 1951, Foundation and Empire, 1952, and Second Foundation, 1953. I, Robot, 1950. The Caves of Steel, 1954. The End of Eternity, 1955. The Gods Themselves, 1972. Foundation's Edge, 1983. And Prelude to Foundation, 1988.